So we are closing up this discussion on the distortions. Very last one here is on seeing the unattractive as attractive. And I have to tell you, I couldn't think of anything but songs when I started thinking about how I was going to give this talk. So we have to throw a few songs in here. I couldn't think. I was so trapped in this kind of way, because one way to begin to think about this distortion, or at least the way I begin to look at it, is that we love the beautiful, the lovely. Like the sutta I read last week, it says that this distortion is sensing, what does it say? Sensing the lovely as the unlovely as lovely. There's something about beautiful, lovely, pleasant, good, nice. It's all kind of, that's the point of life, we begin to think. You know, we look for that which is beautiful and lovely and kind and sweet and all of that sugary kind of stuff that's really, really nice. And it's kind of hard to see the distortion around this loveliness. So if you think of impermanence, the first distortion we talked about, as being the most important distortion, and you think of thinking something is going to satisfy you that is inherently unsatisfactory as being pretty common, that's like our addictions, like common. And then if you think of taking, seeing self or taking something personal that's not personal, that's sort of the hard one. That's the one that we have the hardest to accept. And then you can think of this lovely seeing attraction in the unattractive as being the most elusive. It's so hard to see, not hard to see because all the distortions are hard to see, but it's kind of hard to see because the mind, I think, thinks that somehow our leaning towards the beautiful or leaning towards the lovely or the attractive somehow makes life better, nicer, kinder. And that if we don't, what we're left with is this evil, dull, icky world. So hopefully I can kind of give you some examples so you will not let the mind trip you, you know, do its little magic trick in that. So since I'm going to talk really about this fourth one, I'm going to hold the generalization kind of stuff that I do till the end and just jump right in with this first thinking mode, the first level. I call that the sleep mode. And my song is the Michael McDonald song, I Keep Forgetting We're Not in Love Anymore. It's sort of what happens. We forget, we slide into the lovely without even, it's such an easy sort of way that we go to sleep. I mean, just think of all the things that you have been attached to, and you're like, okay, I'm attached to this, I want to start, take it away. So don't think so much just in terms of lovely being something that you see like a beautiful flower, but I can get attached to television. And it seems pleasant sitting watching all these. I have movies that I have seen at least 1,000 times. I know every ooh-ah word in that movie. And I watch it every time like it's the first time I've ever seen it. Like, there's just these movies I love, and I just watch them over and over and over and over and over. And it has to do with the feeling of loveliness and pleasantness that comes. And I forget that I have seen this 1,000 times. I forget. I just slide into it in this kind of sleep way. So one of the examples I don't know if I told you guys this week, last week, I hope I didn't. But one of the ways I tried to notice when attachment would show up when I was at the retreat is watch shoes. Did I tell you about the shoes? Good. So I would sit in the dining hall and position myself so that I would have to see everybody walking by. And all I would do is watch the shoes. The point was to just watch the shoes and don't put any judgment around it. Just watching shoes, no big deal. But what I noticed is, whenever I would notice what I was doing, I would be gone on some pair of shoes down the way, like, those are too cute. It's as if I didn't even know that I had left the shoes until I would hear myself or notice like my head no longer looking the way it should be looking. And then I would look at the next, go back, okay, I'm just gonna watch the shoes. That's it. Then I would see something else and I'm off watching that. The color, if the color was so coordinated, I'm off watching that. So I tried to watch when my head would shift towards this moving. And it's amazing. I thought that I was leaving the shoes to watch something I liked. But actually, I was leaving the shoes as a distraction from this boredom. Like, I mean, you can watch shoes only so long. And then after a while, it's like, really? Isn't there something else we could do besides watching shoes? So I would be watching these shoes, watching these shoes, watching these shoes. At some point, I would get bored with the watching the shoes. How many pairs of two shoes can you see? And then I would go off onto something else. It's the lovely that helped me get distracted. It's the lovely that sort of helped me fall asleep and slide on off of it without even the slightest bit of worry about it. That's why this lovely is kind of difficult to, it's elusive, because the lovely seems like this is such an easy, nice way to turn. What His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama said is, achieving genuine happiness may require bringing about a transformation in your outlook, your way of thinking, and this is not a simple matter. It's not a simple matter to deal with these distractions, these distortions, the way we're talking about them. It seems simple that I just go to sleep whenever something lovely comes along and I'm bored, and it's just some thought that is, we're in the middle of a meditation, it's been 20 minutes, okay, I did a good job, all right. And then all of a sudden you're off on some boredom thing, some simple little sweet thing. It just takes us away. It seems like it's not, what's the harm in that? But it's not an easy matter to see these distortions, but beginning to see these distortions become more and more and more important. That's what I'm hoping by the end you will begin to see. So we're going to move to the second one. The second one, this is our perception. And the song that kept showing up for me is, I only have eyes for you. But I need to read this song, because this song, it's not just the words. It actually says exactly what we do when we get around the pleasant, the lovely, that which we think is attractive. It says, my love must be kind of a blind love. I can't see anyone but you. And dear, I wonder if you find love an optical illusion too. Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright, because I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon may be high, but I can't see a thing in the sky, because I only have eyes for you. I don't know if we're in a garden or on a crowded avenue. You are here, so am I. Maybe millions of people go by, but they all disappear from view. I only have eyes for you. That's what we do when we get caught in the lovely. We don't see anything else. We see just the lovely. We don't see where we're at. We don't see how it fits in with things. We don't question it. In fact, it's the reason why life is great, right? It's so pleasant. It's so beautiful. The idea of trying to see something lovely as unattractive almost has a hint of making life kind of bland and boring. And why would I do that? Because it's so beautiful and it's so lovely. It's that perception that we get caught into. And when the mind, because we have this kind of mind that is forever looking for and assessing any danger, all the lovely stuff is okay. It's almost as if the mind goes about its danger-seeking job, and it lulls us over into the lovely and says, you ego self, you go sit over here with the little happy place, and I'll continue to work on my assessing danger and looking for danger. And so as long as I'm feeling good and feeling great, I think everything is okay. I don't question whether or not something's okay or not okay. I don't even question what I give up to be okay. If I feel okay and I feel good, that's it. This is the way it's supposed to be. And then we're going along happy, feeling good, everything's going great, and then I feel this twinge of unhappiness. Unpleasant. Something's not lovely. It's so easy to just swat it away, dismiss it, because it's disrupting the way things are supposed to be, which is lovely, pleasant, nice. We don't even, we sleep and we're so only have eyes for you that we don't even notice that we just swatted away something that could have been our liberation. But because it's unpleasant, it has got to be wrong. The example I want to give is this, when I was at the retreat, I'm used to going to Cloud Mountain for retreats, and so Cloud Mountain's kind of food is kind of the same. I'm used to the taste. I know what they're going to serve. I've tasted everything they've ever served, and I like it, right? It's good. It agrees with me. I don't know if you guys have been to Spirit Rock, but they don't cook like they cook at Cloud Mountain. I mean, I think they hire like Maine chefs from all over San Francisco. They do some pretty elaborate cooking. And it's spicy and it's seasoned and it's just very different. So I used to use the food as a way to try to watch myself decide what was good food, what was bad food. And I begin to notice that if I looked at something and it didn't look good, it's bad. It's bad. But if it didn't look good, I could maybe get myself to try it a little bit. And my mind was always open for the possibility that once I tasted it, if it tastes good, looks good, smells good, tastes good, this is good. I go back and get some more, right? It's good. If something didn't taste good, it's bad. I would try to get myself just to experience the taste of something that I think is not good. It's not even possible. I couldn't even get myself to even try to taste this. This is what I mean. You have to try this at home. If there's something that you don't like the way it tastes, try tasting it. It's almost impossible to lift it up to your mouth and put it in there. Because you already know it doesn't taste good. It doesn't taste good. I shouldn't be eating this. This is stupid. Why would I eat this? It doesn't taste good. But then I tasted something that caused my mind a little bit of difficulty. I don't know what the seeds are, but they're little black seeds. And when I first saw it, it was on bok choy, and I first saw it, I'd never tasted these black seeds. I mean, I have tasted them, but I don't know. They're in Asian food, so I've tasted them, but I didn't know what they were. And I see them on this bok choy, and I'm negotiating whether or not I'm going to get any of this bok choy, because something's wrong. But I get it, and I'm going to be good about this. Take it to the table, take a bite, and I noticed this kind of, I don't know about this. But the mind had not made up its mind that it's a good or bad. Then I take another bite and I'm like, oh, this isn't so bad. Take another bite, it tastes kind of strange, but it's not so bad. And I watch the mind as I keep taking bites try its best to put this in a category of good or bad. Because if it's bad, I'm not going to eat anymore. I'm just going to leave it on the plate and toss it when I'm through. If it's good, I'm going to finish it all. So the mind is like stuck in this place of trying its best to figure out whether this is good or bad. So I know you might be thinking, what is the point of this? I mean, so what if a flavor is good or bad and whether I like it or I don't like it, right? What's the point of that? And the point that I'm trying to get you to begin to see is that these are distortions. There is just a flavor in this whatever it is. There is no good, bad. That opinion, that judgment comes from me. It comes from my thinking about it. It comes from my perception. It's not inherent in the object itself. But that evaluation that the mind makes, if we don't watch the sleight of hand that the mind kind of does, then we take that evaluation as if that is the truth of that object. Which kind of leads to the third way of looking at things, the third mode, when it comes to this kind of human view, as Andrea Fella called it, the basic meat of this distortion. And the song that I thought about is the song, Isn't She Lovely? Because the idea is that isn't she lovely means that she is lovely. It's the object that's lovely. It's the object that's good, object that's bad, object that's attractive or not attractive. We don't notice that it's coming from us. It's not coming from the object itself. The object itself has no inherent loveliness to it or not. If we begin to only see loveliness or this kind of way that life is pleasing in the objects that the mind has decided is lovely, beautiful, attractive, then we get caught in this kind of distorted way that the mind decides what is lovely, what is not. I'm going to give you an example of how this shows up. There's a part of me that says I probably shouldn't be saying this, but you know when something like that happens, you probably shouldn't. But so for years, I've been a prosecutor for 25 years. And for 25 years, I've been reviewing cases, looking at cases, you know, taking cases to trial, you know, just that's my job. And usually when you're reviewing cases in the morning, there's a place called a warrant desk. You show up early in the morning, like, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, you're looking at all these cases for people who are in custody or out of custody, and they have hearings that day. And one day I was sitting there with a friend of mine, and I said something about, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to do this case. And she asked me, she's on the other side, she said, why? I said, oh, because this is a terrible case. And she goes, what makes it so terrible? I'm like, it's just a terrible case. I can just tell. It's a terrible case. It's terrible. She's like, well, what is it? So I'm looking at this case, and it's just a regular, normal case. No big deal. I cannot figure out why this case is so terrible. And then I noticed it's the number. So the number, the way the number flowed did not flow the way I think a good number is. There's a good number and a bad number. And the bad numbers, bad cases. Good numbers, good cases. And to make it matter worse is, the reason why the number is good is because our numbers are color-coded so that it's easy to find the file. So if the colors blend together in this kind of a beautiful way, that's a good case. But if the colors are all disjointed, messed up, bad case. I didn't even notice that I was judging cases that way. So here I would get my stack of cases for trial. And if the colors and the numbers look crazy, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a hard case. All because we lean towards the lovely. Another way you could think about it is, in your job, you have some assignment to do. Oh, I can't do that assignment. How come? Something in there feels like it's not easy, it's not simple, there's something wrong with it. It's not lovely. It's not, you know, it doesn't fit together right. Something's wrong with it. And then we don't want to do it. We kind of push over here to something else that seems like it's going to flow really easy. It's going to flow good. This is good. This is right. That is wrong. It's beginning to question that edge of why are we so attracted to something, because the something we're so attracted to is not attractive. We think it's attractive. But why is that? And you're looking for the loveliness in that. So all of this, I want to tie all of this together. Wait, let me first give you this Chöngyam Trungpa Rinpoche, Pema Chodron's teacher said, we say that the sun is behind the clouds, but actually it is not the sun, but the city from which we view it that is behind the clouds. If we realize that the sun is never behind the clouds, we might have a different attitude towards the whole thing. Kind of strange here, right? Because we think the sun is behind the clouds, but the sun has never moved. It's in the same place it's always been. And if we were in Everett, we wouldn't think that the sun was behind the cloud, because they have sunshine. We have clouds, so we think the sun is behind the clouds. The idea is to begin to change our view about some of this. And the way we're going to change it is to begin to feel into some of the difficulty. All these distortions, I realized, all point to impermanence. Right? Out of all the things that Buddha could have saw, he could have saw all kinds of things. He could have came out and said, the whole practice is about love. And there's love in the practice, but the whole practice is about impermanence. So why would he, after spending all that time sitting, that's what he saw, impermanence. And these distortions are our mind's way of making something, making that impermanence obscure to us. Satisfaction. So if we think something is permanent and we don't let it be impermanent, that's pretty self-explanatory. But when we take something to be satisfactory, that's not inherently satisfactory. We are creating a permanent stopgap there, saying that this, taking it out of its natural flow, that it's going to leave us at one point, it's not going to satisfy us, it's not going to help us. We take it out of that and create this permanency to it and say, this is going to satisfy me. It will not. Or we take something out of this flow that it's not personal and it's, you know, life just moves on without us. And we try to solidify it and say, this has value. This is me. This is mine. And again, it's just going to flow right through our fingers at some point. It's the same way with attractiveness. We try to make this distinction that this is the place where I'm going to find the happiness. This is attractive. This is the sweet thing. This is going to be the good thing. And it is not. It has no inherent goodness, loveliness to it. It's only in our eyes. And you know, I only have eyes for you. It doesn't take a lot of people to realize that that is a temporary state. Because, you know, a few years from now, maybe eyes not so much for you. So it's the impermanence that we're looking for in this distortion. How is this moment that I feel this irritation blocking my impermanence, my ability to see the natural flow of life? And the way to see that blockage is when you feel something uncomfortable, unpleasant, not right. When you feel that not right, uncomfortable, not pleasant, don't go the other direction. Don't look for something to try to make it right. You stay right there with it so that you can see how the mind is trying to distort your reality so you will lull back into this sleepiness. I rarely look at my notes. That could be a good thing, that could be a bad thing. But this I want to actually read from the notes. It says, basically, all these distortions, they point to impermanence. They point to our deluded thinking that tries to somehow or another make things permanent. That need to make things permanent is the roller coaster ride that we're on in life. We want to get off that roller coaster ride. We want to have some security, some stability, some sense of groundedness. And we think the permanency is going to make that roller coaster ride less up and down. But actually, the more you practice with this and the more you look at this, if you just ride the natural flow of life, that is what brings us our stability and our sense of security, not this permanency we keep holding on to. It actually creates a much wider, much bigger roller coaster because we drop so far from these places of permanency. And what I wanted to bring out when I said that Buddha could have seen other things is just think about the way we go to, when you go to college. There is psychology, all this psychology, all this intelligence, all of these social sciences that Buddha could have seen. And it all boils down to one thing, and that is impermanence. That has got to tell us that impermanence is pretty big. And we kind of take it for granted sometimes, or kind of poo-poo it. It's not really a big deal. So when we practice, what we're doing is we're setting this intention to see the difficult. We're sitting here saying, I don't want to suffer anymore, so I want to see where I'm suffering so I can let go of it. And the more we see that suffering, the more it's proof that we are practicing good. It's almost as if when we practice, we think that if I keep seeing all this suffering, it's like I must be doing something wrong because I keep seeing all this suffering. You are not. You keep seeing all this suffering, you keep looking at it because that's the doorway out. That seeing the suffering is our first noble truth. Investigating that suffering instead of running from it is the second truth. And when you see the distortion underlying where that suffering is coming from, that is the cessation of it, the third truth. The fourth truth is our working with the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, when you start working with the Eightfold Path, you know what it's going to show you. All the suffering that's going on in your life. The more you work with the path, the more suffering you see, more you investigate, see the distortions. And eventually, something will come along, like my sofa that I just bought. They sent it to me. It doesn't have any legs. So I called them up and I said, it doesn't have any legs. Can you send me the legs? They're like, we don't have a way to send you the legs. What are we going to do here, right? You have to send the sofa back. We will credit your account. And then we will reorder the sofa and send it to you with the legs. You see how you're laughing? That's what I did. I busted out and started laughing. I said, are you kidding me? The point is that you begin to see that the everydayness of life is less and less, even with all of the struggles we have. It's easier and easier to manage. Less and less and less is this uncomfortableness a bad thing. It's like our doorway in. So take a moment and sit here quietly.